and the board's meeting schedule is available at kaxc.org. Partly sunny today, high 62 to 67, breezy northwest winds, lows tonight in the upper 40s. A mix of clouds and sun tomorrow, highs 59 to 64, and winds from the northwest up to 25 miles per hour.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, a former federal prosecutor on legal challenges to the Trump administration's flexing of federal power. And Fed Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell says interest rates might soon be cut. Wall Street swoons. Colleges reopen after many students from around the world have had anxious summers. And Judy Catrone is among those inflamed by what tastes to her like unexplained changes to their favorite breadcrumbs.
So this is really personal for people, because this is what home tastes like.
Yum, yum. First our newscast. Today is Saturday, August 23rd, 2025.
KAXC News, I'm Larissa Donovan with the Up North Report. The data center construction boom remains on Minnesota's radar with new environmental protections in place, but two cities face lawsuits with claims they are falling short in getting a read on how much future projects would drain natural resources. The Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy this week took legal action against the cities of Lakeville and North Mankato, arguing local leaders did not follow state law under the environmental review process when advancing projects. Evan Mulholland, staff attorney at the center, says the evaluations left a lot to be desired.
We don't know how much water they're going to use. For energy, we don't know where the energy is going to come from. We don't know whether they're going to have contracts for clean energy, for carbon-free energy or not. All of these things are just missing.
He pointed out the public is also left in the dark about potential noise when equipment is running to store digital data and keep computing machines cool. This spring, state lawmakers extended tax breaks to lure more centers, along with tougher environmental regulations. Advocates said the safeguards are a good step, but not enough. When reached for comment, North Mankato officials say they led an open review process. Data centers are known for massive water consumption and pushing energy demand higher. In some cases, developers request to implement backup diesel generators, potentially adding to their carbon footprint. Mulholland stressed they are not against such facilities, recognizing the need to accommodate digital use in everyday life. He emphasized they are seeking transparency when measuring the environmental impact.
Some of these cities have signed non-disclosure agreements with the developer, and it's becoming an obstacle for the public to understand what it is being proposed to be built.
North Mankato officials said they were looking at different types of development, prompting a broad review without specific details. But the lawsuit contended city staff used the term data center in emails when discussing the matter. The plaintiffs are requesting a stop to project activity, including permitting, until a more detailed environmental assessment is done. It's a burden many Minnesota parents can relate to, struggling to afford childcare or finding an open slot. Now, a decades-old idea to create equal access around the country is getting another look. The U.S. childcare system is often described as broken, with states and local governments pursuing a patchwork of solutions, along with limited federal subsidies for low-income households. The nonprofit think tank, the Roosevelt Institute, led a new report calling for a, quote, public option approach with stronger federal investments to close gaps. Lena Billick, a program manager for the Institute, said despite the urgency, attempts to solve this crisis for working parents have been uneven at best.
We keep tinkering around the edges, but, you know, what we really need is for childcare to be a public good.
The author suggested, like public schools, there should be a universal network of care sites to guarantee free slots without means testing. Instead of subsidies and tax credits, they called for a big boost in federal aid for providers so they can expand and hire staff and keep costs down. The policy push traces back to the 1970s, but has faced political resistance along the way. On average, childcare costs account for nearly 19% of a Minnesota family's income. While this idea still has opponents, elected leaders from all parties have filed bipartisan bills in response to the childcare shortage. The Economic Security Project is a partner in the report. Taylor Jo Eisenberg, executive director of the nonprofit Economic Security Project, is among those who see it as an infrastructure investment to help the economy by keeping parents in the workforce.
And so I think understanding these as tools, not just to meet the needs of families right now, but as a kind of foundation of a healthy, dynamic economy and country is a really important part of the story.
Some of the national pushback against a universal system suggests it would erode the quality of care. Billick countered one of their recommendations strongly advises against provisions like deregulation.
A trend around the country is sort of changing adult to child ratio rules to deal with the shortage of staff. Now, that might sound okay, but then you picture a room, we're talking literal babies or infants that need care, and you need a lot of adults for that.
Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Larissa Donovan, telling the stories of Northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report is made possible by Woodland Bank, serving the area since 1920 with locations in Grand Rapids, Cohasset, Hill City, and Deer River. Woodland Bank believes in building community and serving local nonprofits like KAXE.
Weekend edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The Trump administration has used presidential powers aggressively. This weekend, troops patrolled the streets of the nation's capital. The FBI has raided the home of a former national security advisor. There's pressure on the Federal Reserve to fire an official on unproven charges, and on Colorado to release a former county clerk who has been found guilty of tampering with electoral machinery. Ankush Kadori is a former federal prosecutor who writes about legal issues for Politico. Joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Federal government, of course, has special authority over the District of Columbia. But not Los Angeles, was also saw a recent troop deployment, and we're waiting for the decision in a lawsuit over the LA deployments. Could that decision deter the president from deploying troops in other cities, which he says he wants to do?
I think it may. If the judge eventually rules that, that the deployment there was unlawful, and that the emergency conditions that the government invoked were not actually present on the ground, it should deter the administration from doing it elsewhere. That ruling would have limited applicability in D.C. potentially, just because D.C. doesn't have a governor, so the relationship between the National Guard and D.C. sort of law enforcement is different than it is in other jurisdictions.
Let me ask about D.C., because, of course, the order the president signed on August 11 declared a crime emergency. But emergency periods can only last for 30 days without congressional approval. Do you think within a couple of weeks now, troops will just go home and that'll be the end of the D.C. deployment?
You know, that's a very significant and open question. It's unclear. I mean, Trump may even just try to extend it to another 30 days. I mean, this is an area of law that is untested, as many areas of law appear to be during the second Trump administration. There are a lot of swirling questions around here. I mean, I think the biggest one and the most key point here is, as a practical matter on the ground, there is no crime emergency in Washington, D.C. right now, whatever you make of the appropriateness of the levels as they currently stand.
What do you make of the FBI raid of former National Security Advisor John Bolton's home Friday morning, reportedly over his handling of classified documents?
You know, I think it's helpful to separate two concepts out. And I tried to remind folks of this as the Trump prosecutions were going on as well. A criminal investigation, a criminal prosecution can have unseemly origins, maybe improper motives behind it. Mm-hmm. And it can also still be the case that the prosecution is supported by the facts and the evidence and the law. So, to my mind, the FBI has said that they've conducted a search A magistrate judge signed off on it, meaning that they had to find probable cause, that there was evidence of crimes in John Bolton's home and the office that was searched. And that evidence should have had to be fairly recent because there are so-called staleness requirements that prevent the government from using really old information to support a new and current search warrant application. So it is entirely possible that they may have found something. I mean, it's also worth recalling that in 2020, mm-hmm. when a judge in D.C. was handling some of the litigation around John Bolton's book, he wrote an opinion, a fairly scathing opinion, saying he believed that Bolton may very well have violated criminal laws at the time.
Let me ask you about a case that's gotten a little less attention nationally, but Tina Peters was a Colorado County elections official found guilty in connection with her attempts to find evidence to support President Trump's false claims the 2020 election was stolen. President is now calling for her release with unspecified consequences if she isn't. Is there anything he can really do, though?
I mean, with respect to a state prosecution in particular, the president does not have the authority to pardon state convictions, although there are, you know, political levers and other mechanisms that he could conceivably pursue to try to have state officials who may have that authority executed on this person's behalf.
So he can bluster, but there's nothing he can do?
Not directly, no.
Let me ask you about the words of Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, who accused the High Court this week of what she called Calvin Ball jurisprudence, referring to that game in the comic strip Calvin and Hobbes, in which she said the administration always wins because there are no fixed rules. What do you make of her analysis?
You know, I hate to say it, but I think it's quite compelling. This Supreme Court this year has handed Trump a series of very significant wins, and particularly wins on this so-called shadow docket, which are really just very quickly resolved matters without the normal briefing, without the normal oral argument, and some of the most high-profile and significant moves in the executive branch, things like firings of people, cutting grants, which is what was at issue in the opinion that we're talking about right now, have been blessed effectively by the Supreme Court, which has let those things go forward pending litigation. And, you know, it is hard to avoid the conclusion, as Justice Jackson noted, that the through line here is that the Trump administration tends to prevail. And I think even if you look closely at the opinion that you know, Jackson was responding to or dissenting from, the various opinions that comprise the majority in that case on the Republican side, the Republican appointee side, they're more or less incoherent. It's just a mishmash of stuff. It would be hard for me to describe a coherent theory that even emerged from those opinions. So I understand her frustration.
Former federal prosecutor Ankush Koduri, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
For the first time, the world's leading authority on starvation has declared a famine outside of Africa. It's in Gaza, and they say it is human-caused, according to a panel of experts at the United Nations-supported group. This is as Israel prepares to occupy Gaza City in its fight against Hamas and risk displacing hundreds of thousands of civilians once again. NPR's Jana Raff joins us from Amman, Jordan. Jane, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
This group, the IPC, has confirmed there is famine in northern Gaza. How did they determine that?
Well, they base it on data, and this is an international body that classifies levels of hunger. It's made up of UN and intergovernmental experts. Famine, of course, is the highest level of classification, and it's based on the percentage of households with severe food shortages and rates of child malnutrition and deaths that are attributable to starvation. And Scott, it was a classification, but it's also a call to action because this group predicts that famine will spread to the center and south of Gaza within the next month if nothing is done.
The UN and other international aid groups insist that the famine was preventable. What do they base that on?
Well, the big factors among them are Israel banning aid shipments to Gaza for more than 2 months earlier this year, and also the destruction of infrastructure and food production, most of it in Gaza itself. It's particularly damning, Scott, on an Israel and U.S.-backed group, the IPC report, I mean. This group is named the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, and it was set up to replace the UN. So the IPC in its report says GHF does not meet the criteria to be considered humanitarian aid. And it found that distribution on average lasted just 23 minutes a day on sites which were 6 hours walk to major centers. And that's distribution under armed security guards that have killed, according to Gaza health authorities, hundreds of people seeking aid. Here's the UN's top humanitarian official, Tom Fletcher.
It is a predictable and a preventable famine. A famine caused by cruelty, justified by revenge, enabled by indifference, and sustained by complicity.
He urged Israel to agree to a ceasefire and to open all the border crossings to get in the massive amounts of food that are needed.
Jane, what has the reaction to this report been in Israel and in Gaza?
Well, the Israeli Prime Minister called the report outright lies and anti-Semitic. He said Israel has a policy of preventing starvation, but Israeli restrictions on the border and even statements by some Israeli government ministers don't bear that out. In Gaza, our producer Anas Baba on the ground spoke to people after the announcement. One of them, Adnan Al-Sayam, who's 65, said he ate only lentils yesterday, and although there's food in the market, hardly anyone can afford it. He says, people are starving. What do they want from these people after 2 years of war?
What is the U.S. position on these questions?
The State Department cast doubt on these findings, and the White House had no comment, although President Trump has in the past acknowledged there is starvation in Gaza. The U.S. ambassador to Israel, Mike Huckabee, blamed hunger in Gaza on Hamas stealing aid. But that's a claim that's been refuted by major aid organizations. There has been reaction in other countries. In the most senior international official to quit over Gaza, the Dutch foreign minister resigned in protest Friday after the government failed to agree on sanctions on Israel.
And Jane, of course, this report comes out as Israel prepares to seize Gaza City in its fight against Hamas. What's happening there?
Well, Israel's defense minister, Israel Katz, has warned that they could level the Gaza Strip's biggest city. They haven't yet issued evacuation orders for the entire city, but they have started in some areas. And we have to remember that many residents of Gaza City have been displaced 7 or 8 times. There are a lot who can't leave. They're either disabled or sick, or there's no transportation. And the places Israel is telling them to go to in the south aren't safe either, because Israel is attacking there too in some places. President Trump has said he supports Israel continuing attacks to release Israeli hostages. But a lot of hostage families in Israel themselves disagree, and they fear their loved ones could be killed in this attack.
And here's Jane Arraf in Amman, Jordan. Jane, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Listening to NPR News.
It's 18 minutes after 8 o'clock. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXE and Weekend Edition. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Bonner Eye Clinic with locations in Grand Rapids and Hibbing. Offering cataract surgery, LASIK, and general eye exams, BonnerEyeClinic.com. Let us help you see clearly. Pokegama Golf Course in Grand Rapids celebrates 100 years today. There will be live music from String Genius. It's open to the public at 7 p.m. You can learn all about Dutch oven cooking at Lake Bemidji State Park today at 1:30. Meet at the fire ring by the dining hall. Seasoned chefs and outdoor enthusiasts will teach you how to care for a Dutch oven, and you'll get to enjoy some tasty treats. And Brainerd Women of Today invite all ages to Chalk the Block on Monday, August 25th from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Spread positivity by drawing or writing uplifting messages on Laurel Street. Meet at Passport Restaurant.
Recently, federal funding for all public media was cut. Besides those federal cuts, KXE has also received cuts from the state of Minnesota for programming you love. We wanted to hear from listeners why they think it's important to show their support for KAXE right now.
Hi, my name is Dave, and I'm a supporter of KAXE, and we have lived in 50 Lakes area for about 3 years and loved the music and the news and all the northern radio shows, and it's become vitally important to us in the car and at home to get our news and music from KAXE. So that's why we feel it's important to keep you guys on the air as long as you want to be on the air. So
make your donation now to help KAXE stay on the air. Go to our website, kaxe.org, and click the word donate.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Visit St. Pete Clearwater, Florida, where visitors can unwind on white sand beaches and dine at restaurants. More at visitspc.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, which monitors safe driving habits to determine a personalized rate at progressive.com. Not available in California or from all agents. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell sent the stock market soaring yesterday with his speech in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Mr. Powell suggested the central bank could soon start cutting interest rates. He also talked about how the Fed plans to balance its twin goals of fighting inflation and unemployment over the longer run. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us. Scott, thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
What got the market so excited?
Investors are betting this means the Fed's going to cut its benchmark interest rate when policymakers meet in about 3.5 weeks. That's after the Fed's been in a holding pattern for the last 8 months. Now, Powell stopped short of promising a rate cut in September, but said one could be warranted given some of the recent signs of a softening job market. We're going to get one more monthly snapshot on jobs before that September meeting. We'll also get one more update about inflation. Powell says it is clear that President Trump's tariffs are putting some upward pressure on prices, but it's not clear how big or persistent those price hikes might be.
The Fed often has to strike a balance between fighting inflation and propping up the job market. How's the central bank approaching that?
Well, its approach is changing a little bit after its most recent review, which it does every 5 years or so. After the previous review back in 2020, the Fed said it was willing to let inflation run a little hotter above its 2% target and would not preemptively raise interest rates just because the unemployment rate was really low. Once the pandemic hit and the war in Ukraine started, though, all that kind of went out the window. And today, Powell says the balancing act looks very different.
The past 5 years have been a painful reminder of the hardship that high inflation imposes, especially on those least able to meet the higher costs of necessities.
So the Fed is no longer talking about letting inflation run above target. It's reiterating that its target is 2% inflation and says it will act forcefully to keep people's expectations in line with that.
Scott, you mentioned the president's tariffs. What other administration policies are affecting the Fed's calculations?
The president has been waging an aggressive crackdown on immigration, which is reshaping the workforce. And the theme of this year's Jackson Hole conference is a workforce in transition. You know, thousands of baby boomers are retiring every day. Americans are not having enough new babies to maintain the population. In recent years, we've relied on immigration to close that gap, but that's largely dried up now. Both legal and illegal immigration are way down. The Trump administration argues this is going to create new opportunities for native-born workers to come off the sidelines and find jobs. But economist Joe Bruzuelas of the accounting firm RSM is dubious.
I am highly skeptical that there's a reserve army of individuals ready to stream in and pick grapes, clean houses, cut yards, and work in meat factories. That's just not there.
Automation and artificial intelligence might help make the existing workforce more productive in the future, but until that happens, we're basically setting a lower speed limit on the nation's economic growth.
Of course, this was Jerome Powell's final appearance at Jackson Hole as Fed chairman. What kind of reaction did he get?
He got a standing ovation, which probably felt pretty good. He's not been getting a lot of applause from President Trump. In fact, Powell has gotten intense criticism from the White House for not moving more quickly to cut interest rates. The Fed is supposed to be insulated from that kind of political influence, so it can make tough, sometimes politically unpopular decisions on interest rates. Bruce Salas warns if that independence is compromised, it will lead to worse economic outcomes.
If we move away from central bank independence, we're not only going to have 3-4% inflation, we're going to have much higher inflation. And we know who's going to bear the burden of those transition costs: the middle class, the working class, and the working poor.
Powell has just 9 months left in his term as Fed chairman, and colleagues took the opportunity of his final Jackson Hole speech to show their support, both for Powell personally and for an independent central bank.
And Pierre Scott Horsley, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now it's time for sports. Pennant races close, but what do they matter anymore? U.S. Open, parity of power in the women's draw, but clear front runners on the men's side. Sports writer Howard Bryan joins us. Howard, thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. And look, several close pennant races in the major leagues in the West, especially National League. Dodgers are tied in first place with the Padres. In the American, the Houston Astros are ahead of the Seattle Mariners by just a couple of games. But does winning your division matter so much?
Well, it doesn't matter the way it used to. I mean, certainly you've got, I think baseball has decided that they're really, really going all in on adding playoff teams. And so what that does statistically is that it really reduces the great team's chances of winning once you get to October. And so what is the purpose of going? It really is my favorite time of the year, Scott. I love when we get to September 1st and you start seeing how many of these teams are really built for the long haul. The Milwaukee Brewers are the best team in baseball right now. And who had that on their bingo card? And Christian Yelich still doing his thing. And so you would like to see a team like Milwaukee feel like they have more than a 9% chance of getting to the World Series, which they haven't gotten to, by the way, since 1982 when they lost to the Cardinals. You've got the Detroit Tigers, a good team that was a good team last year, and suddenly the Toronto Blue Jays are one of the best teams in baseball, even though the Red Sox and Yankees are both pretty good teams this year, and they're playing each other in New York this weekend. And so, and of course, we've been giving the whole world to the Dodgers, to the gazillion-dollar Dodgers and the defending world champion Dodgers, and they're tied for first place with the Padres. So obviously having extra playoff teams is great in some ways because you're going to get to see some of these teams a little bit more if they don't quite win, you know, get to first place. But on the other hand, it really does undermine the entire idea. Why are we here? Why are we playing 162 games if everyone's going to make the playoffs?
Yeah, good question.
Why are we here? It's my existential question for you, Scott. Why are we here?
Oh, Howard, you answer that question. We'll get to that next time you're on. First round of the U.S. Open tomorrow. Not a clear favorite in the women's draw. It's interesting. Defending world champion and number one world-ranked player, Aryna Sabalenka, hasn't won a Grand Slam this year. Is this an era of parity in women's tennis?
Well, it has been. I think we've all, the hard part about tennis especially is that we measure tennis more than any other sport. Maybe basketball is close, but we measure tennis in terms of dominance. Serena, Nadal, Djokovic, Federer, all of them, Chrissy, Martina, it's always the one name. Well, we don't really have a one name this time in the post-Serena era, and that's perfectly okay. All the other sports really try to sell parity. Why not tennis? And so you do have Aryna Sabalenka, who's the world number one, but she's not super dominant. She's a great player, but Coco Gauff is a great matchup for her, and Coco Gauff has beaten her twice in Grand Slam finals. I think that Iga Swiatek, who finally won Wimbledon, is probably the best player in the world right now. And so there are a lot of good players, and that's perfectly fine. And I think that this tournament is going to, it's going to make or break Sabalenka's season, obviously, because when you're the world number one and you don't win a title, that says a whole lot. But on the other hand, there were a lot of good players out there, and New York is the best place for it. But on the men's side, there is absolutely
Yeah.
There are two.
Two names, right.
There are two names. And we went from the big three, Nadal, Djokovic, and Federer, to the new two, which is Jannik Sinner and Carlos Alcaraz. But however, there is one name when we get to New York that I think we should still remember,
yeah.
And that is 38-year-old Novak Djokovic. Djokovic is still... He's a seventh seed, I believe, but at the same time, the only guys to beat Djokovic in a full match without him retiring due to injury really have been Sinner and Alcaraz. Nobody else has really taken down Novak in a Grand Slam in a five-set match. So to me, it's the three. I still think it's Sinner's the best player in the world. Alcaraz is neck and neck with him. And until somebody knocks out Djokovic, I'll believe it when I see it.
Yeah. Well said. All right. Sports writer Howard Bryant, thanks so much for joining us. Talk to you in a couple of weeks, my friend. Take care.
My pleasure, Scott.
An eerie new immersive play in New York City has no live actors. Instead, six people at a time put on headphones and listen to a recorded story as they wind their way through a labyrinth. NPR's Jennifer Vanasco joined in.
We're lying on our backs in sleeping bags on the floor, like we're at a slumber party. We're in a bedroom from the 90s.
A teenage girl's bedroom with all of the sort of bands that she loves, all the books she's reading, all the little toys she's collecting.
That's Felix Barrett. He's the artistic director of Punch Drunk Theatre, based in London, and the creator and director of the show. It's called Viola's Room, and it's at The Shed, a cultural center in Manhattan. As it starts, we hear the music Viola listens to.
The radio's playing. It's completely cinematic.
Our feet are bare. The lights are dim. A tiny ballerina is spinning in her jewelry box, and her shadow looms over us on the wall.
The music starts to slip, starts to transform, starts to melt. And as that happens ever so slowly, the lights go down in the bedroom to pure darkness.
And Helena Bonham Carter begins to tell us a bedtime story.
Let me tell you a story from a long, long time ago.
When the lights ease up, we crawl through a child's play tent.
Crawling on hands and knees through the dusty secret ways.
And into a dark fairy tale of narrow hallways and semi-darkness.
She thought she knew every inch of that place and its grounds, knew all of its secrets. It was not true.
The story she tells is about a princess, a maze, a pair of dancing shoes, the irresistible pull of the moon. It's the kind of lyrical eeriness Punch Drunk is known for. In their last show in New York, called Sleep No More, audiences explored creepy, detailed rooms based on Macbeth. It ran for almost 13 years and just closed in January. Barrett says Viola's Room is more intimate, but all sorts of theatrical immersion offer audiences something they don't often get in our world of screens and video projections.
Everything's accessible, everything's two clicks away, whereas a live tactile experience that's 360, that's something where you're plunged into a different universe.
Barrett points out that the headphones and the sound design used in Viola's Room make it feel like the story is being told only to you.
Helena's vocal work is so incredible. Like when she was recording it, like her bottom lip was on the microphone. And so we imagined that, you know, her lips are touching your earlobe.
No live actors mean that design of the show is everything. Casey J. Andrews designed the physical part of the experience, what you can see and touch. Gareth Fry, the sound. He says most of the show uses conventional mixing techniques, like what you hear on the radio or on a podcast.
Every now and again, I'd use this technique called binaural sound, which is this sort of more three-dimensional use of sound that really only works on headphones. And so that enables us to create these moments where you're not quite sure what is real and what's on the soundtrack.
There's a moment when you're in all of her dresses and they start getting dirtier and you're feeling the mud and the dirt on these dresses that have just been... There's heaps of them and you're kind of passing through. And there's a moment where it sounds like Helena Bonham Carter just whispers in your ear.
Go quickly.
We swap the microphone and use a thing called a binaural head, which mimics human recording. Oh. And at that moment, it feels like... Oh, you know, all the rules have suddenly shifted and we're not listening to this story, we're in this story.
with the headphones on suddenly, in the dresses, in the dark, with the smell of them and feeling the texture of the mud on them, and then her whispering in your ear to, you know, get out, go quickly, I jumped out of my skin.
I did too, but not like it was a jump scare. More like I was waking from a vivid dream. Jennifer Vanasco, NPR News, New York.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. International students from around the world are arriving on U.S. college campuses.
My name is Priyota, and I'm from Bangladesh.
I'm Karshati, and I'm from India.
My name is Rebecca, and I'm from Jamaica.
I'm Minjae from Seoul, South Korea.
Those are students at the University at Buffalo on campus after a very rocky summer and long delays at consulates. NPR's Alyssa Nadworn has been reporting in Buffalo this week at orientation. Joins us in our studios. Alyssa, thanks for being with us.
Happy to be here, Scott.
You've especially been looking at first-year international students. What have they told you?
Well, at orientation, I tagged along as students got their new campus IDs and went on tours. They are from more than 100 countries, and many of them told me how grateful they were to have finally made it to campus and how stressful it was this summer to get visas.
At least we're here. For me, the main thing is that I got here.
That's Daria Tofan from Romania. I met her and Karshati Gugward from Pune, India, at an icebreaker event.
Was the visa process hard?
Oh, don't ask me about it. It was awful. No, it was.
Uncertainty is crazy.
They shut down the embassies
the
worldwide.
Thing is, I was the last slot before they shut down, so I felt I just prayed so hard to God. I was like, this is the time where I remember you.
Many of their peers didn't get their visas on time, so this fall, the university is expecting a decline of about 750 international students, many in their graduate programs, mostly in STEM fields. But there are still 4,000 international students on campus, and they make up a big part of the culture at the university.
Listen, remind us of the political backdrop here.
Well, the Trump administration is really focused on international students. They temporarily paused visa interviews around the globe early summer. Then they revamped the student visa application and interview process. And so it meant delays for some students who haven't, you know, been able to get visas in time for the fall. President Trump has said he wants to keep campuses safe. Earlier this spring, the State Department revoked about 6,000 student visas, citing threats of academic espionage, support for terrorist groups in Gaza, and criminal behavior. And he's said he wants to make sure that foreign students aren't taking spots that could go to American citizens.
Just to be explicit here, Alyssa, the administration hasn't shown evidence that there is widespread support for terror or any criminality among these students.
That's right.
Tell us about schools in addition to the one you saw at the University at Buffalo.
So there are about 1 million students every year that study in the United States. Of course, they're at places like Harvard and Columbia, which we hear a lot about, but they're also at public universities in places like Arkansas, Indiana, and Arizona. We don't have a full picture yet of what international enrollment is going to look like nationwide, but some estimates say it could be down as much as 15% overall. And a lot of schools have reported these enrollment drops, including Buffalo. You know, one thing a lot of university leaders have told me, Scott, is that they're watching to see if this is going to be short or long term. Will this impact students applying for next year? Like, how long is this going to last? I've also talked to a lot of students who are thinking about maybe they'll go to universities in the UK or South Korea or even Canada.
What could that potentially mean for the U.S.?
International students contribute big time to the economy. One study estimated in a year nationally, they pump about $43 billion into it. And, you know, Scott, they make campus communities more enriched. They also help balance university budgets. A lot of international students pay full tuition, and so that money often helps increase things like financial aid that ultimately benefit American students too.
Alyssa Nadworny, thanks so much.
You bet.
Thank you. This is NPR News.
It is 8:39. Thanks for listening to Weekend Edition on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up on Stay Human at 9 o'clock, we'll hear about a pop-up art show that happened last week, Words as Buried Seeds. We'll hear from the organizers and others about the scene. That's coming up this morning at 9. You can also catch it tomorrow evening at 5. Support comes from Summer Muse Festival in Bemidji, a monthly all-inclusive music and creative arts gathering that is open to the public, held at the Rail River Folk School. The next event is Saturday, August 30th from 4 to 8 p.m. More information at summermusefestival.com. Northern Community Radio's Board of Directors meets 6 p.m. this Monday, August 25th at KBXE in Bemidji. It's an open meeting. Members and the general public are invited to attend. For more information, email comments at kaxe.org. Regular meetings of our Board of Directors are the fourth Monday of the month. Find a schedule at kaxe.org.
Here with these headlines. South Korean President Lee Jae-myung is on his first official visit to Japan since taking office in June. He met with Japan's prime minister today ahead of Lee's planned summit meeting with President Trump on Monday. Hawaii's Kilauea volcano has resumed its eruption. It shot lava high into the air on Friday, marking its 31st eruption since December. And lava has been bubbling from one of Kilauea's vents. The volcano is one of the world's most active. And the college football season gets underway today. A handful of games on the schedule, with Iowa State and Kansas State kicking things off. Their game is set to get underway in a few hours from Dublin, Ireland. I'm Giles Snyder, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Since 1946, AU has supported the First Amendment right of freedom of religion. More at au.org. From Melville Charitable Trust, committed to ensuring all people have a safe, stable, and affordable home that allows them to thrive. Information about ways to prevent and solve homelessness is at melvilletrust.org. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Officials in Orlando are outraged that the State Transportation Department painted over a rainbow crosswalk outside the former Pulse nightclub. The street art was a memorial to the 49 people killed in the mass shootings at the LGBTQ plus club in 2016. As Joe Burns with Central Florida Public Media reports, locals protested the surprise erasure this week.
About 200 people showed up to protest the day after the removal of the colorful crosswalk. At the demonstration, Democratic State Senator Carlos Guillermo Smith called it a hostile act and a, quote, insult to the families and survivors of the Pulse tragedy.
Somewhere nearby, sometime very soon, there will be a mural painted. It will be bigger. It will be more queer. And it will be more colorful than they ever imagined. Because we will not be erased.
Whose streets? Our streets. Whose streets?
Protesters raised signs and waved large pride flags as drivers on South Orange Avenue honked their horns. People used chalk to recolor the crosswalk in rainbow hues and scribbled messages. Crouching on the pavement, 29-year-old Alexis Bishop wrote in pink chalk, queer joy, rest, love, resistance. Bishop says painting over a memorial to the Pulse victims was hurtful.
It's upsetting. More than anything, we all sit here, we're stunned, because why? Why cover it?
Republican Governor Ron DeSantis wrote on X, we will not allow our state roads to be commandeered for political purposes. Empowered by a new state law, the Florida DOT directed cities to remove street art that's, quote, associated with social, political, or ideological messages. Some cities, like West Palm Beach, have removed their rainbow crosswalks on their own. Others, like Key West, are pushing back. Orlando officials weren't given that chance. During the protests, fragments of real rainbows were visible. For Senator Smith, it was a sign.
We looked up into the sky. And there was not one, but there were two double rainbows. which is a reminder that the universe is with us.
Minutes later, the downpour came and erased the rainbow crossing once again. For NPR News, I'm Joe Burns in Orlando, Florida.
Whether or not you use AI, the headlines heralding its rise have been hard to ignore. The chief executive of OpenAI, Sam Altman, wrote in 2021, "This technological revolution is unstoppable." But what happens when the so-called revolution hits a speed bump? The latest versions of AI chatbots have left some users wanting more. New study has cast doubts on the efficacy of AI in the workplace, and Altman's now talking about a potential bubble in the industry. Later today on All Things Considered, new reporting on AI's possible limitations. You can tune in on, you know, the radio, or tell your smart speaker to play NPR or your member station by name. Sarah Grant is a scientist working on a genetically modified strain of wheat for a major corporation. She finds documents showing that her employer has buried tests that reveal that their product can have dangerous side effects. Sarah takes those documents, and we meet her as she's seeking help from a law firm.
Ms. Grant, I commend you on your intentions here, but we're no longer looking for this type of business. There are a number of highly regarded whistleblower support organizations much better prepared.
No, it's not whistleblowing support I need. It's the opposite. I just want to give everything back. I promise to keep my mouth shut and get on with my life.
But can she really do that? Are things as they really seem? Relay is the film that stars Lily James and Riz Ahmed. The film is directed by David McKenzie, whose previous works include Under the Banner of Heaven and Hell in High Water. David McKenzie joins us now from our studios in Culver City, California. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hi there.
I gather the screenplay has been around for a while. What drew you to it?
I like the material. I thought there was something very interesting about the sort of world of urban espionage and the sense of a lonely character in New York trying to kind of fight the system. Yeah, I came across the script in 2019 and then worked a little bit with the writer, Justin Piasecki, and eventually we were able to make it.
Tell us about the two main characters around whom the film is built. There's Sarah, and I guess a man we'll call a fixer, whom she ultimately turns to for help. He's played by Riz Ahmed, and he goes by many names.
He definitely goes by multiple disguises, multiple names, and he tries to live below the radar. And one of the things in particular that he does is he uses this old technology for the deaf, the relay system, where you would speak to an operator would relay the message to the person who was hard of hearing with some kind of text, using a device called a TTY machine. And the person who was hard of hearing would relay it back using the machine, and then the operator would relay it to the person using their voice. And that system is still in place today. It's becoming increasingly redundant because of newer technology. But his analog kind of version of getting through there, the operators are not allowed to disclose any of the information they're saying or they're hearing. And so it's a way of communicating with people that is below the digital radar, which is how he is able to kind of exist without being noticed by the corporate kind of henchmen, security people who are on the tail of Sarah and trying to harass and intimidate her. And that's why she finds Riz's character in the first place.
Well, tell us about Riz Ahmed's character. Without revealing too much, we see him at Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and he feels that he's been a coward.
Yes. Riz's character is himself a former whistleblower, and he decided to succumb to the harassment and intimidation and finally the kind of offer of a paycheck for his silence, and has regretted that ever since and feels that he needs to help people who are in this turmoil as whistleblowers. You know, the life of a whistleblower is a hard thing. They're left sort of isolated and lonely and questioning whether they did do the right thing, which is sort of sad. So that's the kind of the basis of his character. You don't reveal that until quite a lot later into the story. The first half hour of the film, Riz's character doesn't actually say anything.
I want to play another clip now, and this is conversation between Sarah, played by Lily James, and the character played by Riz Ahmed. And they, you know, try and stay separate from each other, right? But that's not always easy.
I recommend we keep communication to a minimum.
Well, you stuck around to listen to all of my last message.
So, are you? Go ahead.
Am I what?
Lonely. Go ahead.
It's strange talking to someone who knows so much about you and you know so little about them. May I ask you a question?
Go ahead.
Depends what it is.
Has it ever gone wrong?
Do I have this right? Lily James and Riz Ahmed were never in the same place at the same time?
For the scenes where they're communicating through the relay operators, they're not. That scene that you just played was originally written as another relay operator call. And something that Riz and I kind of evolved was when we were kind of rehearsing and working through the film was the idea that that he was reaching out a little bit further than his professional distance should allow. So he decides to pretend to be a relay operator and make the call himself. It's almost a romantic scene. It's got a sort of crispy, unresolved romantic tension in there. You know, there's something really beautiful about him actually speaking to her and she assuming that he's the operator.
Tell us a bit about their relationship. What kind of feelings develop?
Together, there is a certain sense that they share a bond of isolation and loneliness. They start to build something which is arguably slightly more than professional.
Yeah. One thing I noticed repeatedly in the film, that there's a level of tension and your characters notice every detail necessarily because it might be a matter of life or death. And that once you notice everything, you begin to suspect almost everything, don't you?
It's the interesting thing about that is that there's a world where it's all a hall of mirrors. And you know, I think, you know, as we live in a sort of, I guess, an increasingly conspiratorial world in some way, you start looking at things and you're going, is that what it really means or is that what it's pretending to mean? And we're playing a bit of that game with the film.
Have you seen much of what AI, artificial intelligence, can do in film work?
Yeah, I am. I'm working on a project that A, is about it and B, is involving it at the moment. And I think recorded reality, that's no longer to be trusted anymore. One can affect images so easily now that the things that we used to rely on as sort of self-evidential truth that you see are no longer so easy to trust.
Yeah. Do you have any concerns about what it might do to film?
I have concerns about it, but I also relish the challenges of trying to work with it. What it does to the industry, you know, who knows? It's almost certain that a lot of people are going to lose their jobs. That's a place of great anxiety. But creatively, that, you know, it would be a shame to be entirely negative about it, because I'm sure there are exciting opportunities to explore for filmmakers.
David McKenzie, he is director of the new film Relay, which is out in theaters now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much for talking to me and for some really interesting questions. Thanks.
Do not mess with breadcrumbs, or maybe mess with caution, but never mess with the theme music B.J. Lederman does for our show. This week, the Philadelphia Inquirer reported on a breadcrumb outrage that is spreading on social media. Some home cooks say they've noticed something is off.
You know what? Now that I'm thinking, my last batch of chicken cutlets tasted funky.
Laura, there's something wrong with the breadcrumb. There's something wrong with the 4C breadcrumb.
The second ingredient after your flour used to be corn syrup. Now it's high fructose corn syrup. They're not the same.
That's a roundup of TikTokers there. Author Judy Cutrone was one of the first to call out the 4C brand for allegedly changing the recipe of its seasoned breadcrumbs. She joins us now from Gray, Maine. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So how did you notice the change?
I noticed because I have a very vocal mother who noticed it pretty immediately. This is a dish. She makes chicken cutlets at least once a week. They're always in the fridge. They're always there if we come home. And you use the same ingredients every time when you're making the dish over and over again. Mm-hmm. She could tell right off the bat that something was off. And she mentioned it to a few people who are also home cooks who use the same product. And they said the same thing. They were noticing that it tasted sweet suddenly. She thought it tasted like cinnamon, which I thought was really odd when she told me. And then she mentioned it to my cousin, who said, I think we figured it out. They definitely changed some of the ingredients in here.
Now, you took this to the court of first and last resort these days, which is TikTok, right?
That's correct.
And what did you hear?
The response was pretty immediate. I think the big takeaway, the thing that I told my mother immediately, I said, I don't think you're alone in this. There are so many comments of people saying there's definitely something different. They definitely taste sweeter. My meatballs are ruined. I've ruined a batch of chicken cutlets. Somebody called it a cutlet apocalypse. The comments are very funny. People are very passionate about this topic.
To say, we're getting a little strident about this, but go ahead, yes.
Yes. But this is a big deal. You know, I actually name-checked the brand of breadcrumbs in my novel. It's about an Italian-American family. The book is a tribute to my mom. Dishes like this are a huge part of our family story, and part of it is the familiarity of how they taste. She knows that she can just make this off of a reflex. It's muscle memory, and she can just use the same ingredients every time, and when she puts it in front of us, it's going to taste exactly the same as when she made them 6 months ago, a year ago, when we were kids. So this is really personal for people, because this is what home tastes like.
Now, I have in front of me a statement sent to us by 4C Foods. Quote, some consumers have asked if we have changed our recipe for 4C seasoned breadcrumbs. We have not. In 2023, we updated our label to comply with government regulations and bakery industry changes. The recipe remains the same. Breadcrumbs, pecorino, Romano cheese, and spices. And they also said they're investigating charges, I guess we'd call them, about a cinnamon taste that some customers say they've noticed. So what's your reaction to their pretty explicit statement?
I would say it's absolutely possible for a recipe to be 100% the same. That doesn't mean that the ingredients or the quality of those ingredients is exactly the same.
Oh.
Corn syrup versus high fructose corn syrup, you're going to see a difference there for sure. The fact that the recipe hasn't changed doesn't do much for me, because you know who also hasn't changed her recipe? My mother.
Oh.
And yet the output is very different.
I feel the need to confess something to you.
Yes.
Every now and then, on those occasions that I am at home and dine alone, I have been known to shake out some breadcrumbs into a teaspoon and just eat them.
Oh, wow. Thank you for feeling safe enough to tell me that. This is a safe space.
I haven't done it recently, but I would notice, right?
You would notice. Something that you eat so often. And I tried it. She had made a batch with the 4C's breadcrumb, and it did taste a little sweet. It didn't taste exactly as I remember.
May I ask, has your mother given any indication if she's just going to find a new line of breadcrumbs?
She's exploring right now. She's exploring breadcrumb options right now.
Well, that's what life and health is all about, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Judy Cotrone, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm still driving with a mouthful of breadcrumbs. Thanks for being with us. Enjoy your weekend.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Maiden, makers of cookware found in restaurants around the world, offering a carbon steel griddle for home use, designed for cooking a range of foods, from eggs and bacon to burgers and fish. More at madeincookware.com. And from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy and helping clients find balance. Clients are matched with one of 30,000 therapists for online therapy from anywhere. At betterhelp.com/public. This is NPR.
It is just before 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXE.org. Thanks so much for your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up next, Stay Human, hosted by Michael Goldberg, a mix of story and song. Coming up at 10 o'clock, Corey Campbell, your volunteer host for Back Porch Harmony. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, our ever-popular Green Cheese Trivia Show with your volunteer host, Mike Berry. Now a message from the Minnesota Department of Health. Sometimes you just need to talk about it, but it can be hard to find someone who really listens. That's why there is 988 with support that meets you where you are. Confidential and staffed by trained folks who want to help when you need someone to talk to. Call or text 988 or chat online at 988lifeline.org. Partly sunny today with highs 62 to 67, breezy northwest winds, and our overnight lows in the upper 40s. For tomorrow, mix of